The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning. Another edition of Sliding Into Your Seat with Aaron, Elizabeth, and Bob. You are joining We the People Radio at KCNR 1460. Ooh, and I noticed on the window, all the writing for Everything You Need to Say is a lot bigger. I like that. Not that I don't have it completely memorized by now, but it's bigger. That's old people writing.
It actually says, this is KCNR 1460.
Community radio.
Just
community.
In case we're pushed. Oh, community radio.
Community, that's new.
When did we change that?
Yeah, there's a reason. There's a new piece of paper up there this week.
Really?
And that
well,
is?
Well, the wording is different. We're now community radio for the North State.
Yes. Oh, we are? Okay. Oh. So you are listening to KCNR 1460 AM, community radio for the North State.
Oh, what did we used to be? What about
KCNR
the Shasta Redding
well,
part?
Free Fire Media.
We're still Free Fire Media. Uh-huh. We still have Free Fire Radio weekday mornings, but we're just emphasizing our community radio.
Yeah, that's
aspect,
good, because so. It really is. Hey, so... if you want to jump on the chat room, go to wethepeopleradio.us. We have an excellent webpage that Robert does for us every week. And
thanks,
everything
Robert.
About our guest today, who happens to be in the studio with us, will be on the webpage. And you can follow along while you listen. And if you want to give us a call, because this is going to be about Obamacare. So for all of those listening, want to know how Obamacare really is going to impact you from a medical standpoint, this is your chance to call in and ask our very special guest. And Aaron, jump in.
Dr. Doug McConnell.
Good morning. Good, nice to be here. Thank you.
It's always nice to pull up to the radio station. I was not late this morning. I want to say I was the second one here after Doug McConnell.
I got a quick little text message last night that said, you know, we probably should be on time tomorrow.
We should probably shoot for 7:55.
Because we actually have somebody showing up to sit in the studio.
Someone will actually notice if we're actually not here. So here was somebody in a white coat at the door looking in, and I thought, well, they've either come to take us away and we're not there yet, or this is our guest.
Pushing the doorbell, and there was no answer. But anyway, you
I didn't know
that.
We had a doorbell.
Yes, you do.
I run right by it every Sunday morning.
Yeah.
I don't think it works.
I can certify that it makes no noise I could hear.
It doesn't help anybody do anything. So you got up at what, 4 o'clock? You've already seen
4
people
o'clock.
Today?
I have. Been at the hospital, made
really?
Rounds, and discharged a patient to home. And we actually
were happy about that.
We did heart surgery yesterday on an 85-year-old gentleman who's actually doing well and having breakfast this morning.
Oh, that's terrific.
Well, that's awesome.
Well, that's
terrific.
It is. It's quite nice. He's going to do fine.
I was actually going to tell people about you, but I'm having trouble bringing this up. Here we go. We had a really snazzy list.
Okay.
Okay.
Is it true?
Apparently, it's true. It's got a picture
it
of
came
you.
From you.
Oh.
It's got a picture of you. Oh, speaking of that, before I forget, there is a website listed on our website. It's douglasmcconnell.com, and I'll save you all the spelling. You can just go there and click on it. But on there, you have some photos.
I do.
I don't know if you guys looked at that at all, but oh my gosh, they are fantastic.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
So... yeah, I mean, Sundial Bridge and all these different things that were just... the one I really liked was the Diesel Horse Bridge, and it kind of looked like arches in Rome.
Three arches. Well, it's a Romanesque bridge.
Right, but I mean, it looked
fabulous.
Like you were there because the water was so smooth underneath, and I looked in the reflection and stuff, and there's a bridge that I was thinking of right there in Rome.
Yeah, that's a popular picture in town. I've given that to many charities, and it's raised quite a bit of money. Because it is. The beauty of photography, you can isolate a lot of the distractions and just concentrate on the arch and the beauty of the arches and the water and the reflections.
There's a reason they're so heavily photographed by so many.
Yeah, I mean, it was really beautiful at night, the one at night with the lights up on top, but that one of just the bridge with the gray arches, that was really...
I'll make you a print.
It was really pretty.
You know, I've got one of the Diesel Horse Bridge taken at night from underneath where you've kind of got the arches going on and the lights and they're reflecting on the water. And my nephew took that shot and submitted it as his senior project when he graduated from Enterprise High School because he chose photography as his senior project.
Oh.
And so there's just so many outstanding.
And you were a photographer too. Bob, you and I are the rookies here. I forgot we've got two photographers
so
here.
So here's a thought. So obviously,
my wife's the photographer in the family.
Photography is very artistic.
Well, it's my I can't paint, and I'm not necessarily a good writer, so it's, I guess that's become my artistic outlet.
Yeah. But so I think probably heart surgery counts too.
But
that's kind of artistic.
See, that was going to be my point that. Yeah. If you're artistic at all, it's going to cross over into the other things that you do. And I would think that being a heart surgeon would require a lot of artistic ability and finesse. And
well, it's a mixture, as is photography, a mixture of optics and science, and then your sense of timing, and you make choices. But ultimately, you depend upon emulsions in the old days of films or the sensors today, and the lighting and optics. And so you're mixing science within the art part, which is decisions and judgment. And of course, heart surgery is both. I mean, we stop the heart. There's a whole biology about how you stop a human heart and then work in it or on it for the next 2 hours, and then keep that heart biologically alive so it can be resuscitated and restarted. Obviously, when you're done fixing it, it doesn't do you any good if the heart muscle doesn't work. So there's a whole science, which I was fortunate enough to be partially responsible for some of that technology way back at UCLA when I was training. But so it is the mixture of the pure laws of science and physics and biology with the artistry of making a small incision with your hand stitching a bypass graft or removing a diseased valve and putting in a mechanical valve. So I guess it's similar. There's hard knowledge and science of the science of biology and physics and structures and materials that is mixed with the artistry of applying that. And that's sort of what photography is too.
Sure. Photography's kind of nice, though. If it doesn't, especially now, if it doesn't turn out right, you just delete the picture.
No pressure. I don't have that option. Once we start, we have to work for hours and finish it, and then you only get one shot.
Yeah, there's no retake.
No.
So I was looking at your list here. The first one always stops me in my tracks. You know, Stanford University honors in molecular biology.
Yes.
As an English major, I'm like, oh, they're doing what over there?
That was a new field, actually a fairly new field, and it's the essence of DNA and how the cells of our body live, which is you and I are really a collection of cells besides our spirit. But the point is every cell in your body has its own respiration, really, and its own energy needs. And so there's a whole science. But that became, in the mid-60s, a whole new field of biology, which people often think of as, you know, dissecting toads and doing this, that. No, it's basically what do the mitochondria do and how do they work and how do you replicate a cell? And you explore the mystery of how a single fertilized cell becomes you. And that one cell has in it all the architectural design information it needs to become your left big toenail or your right eye or your ear or a lung.
It's amazing.
And that's – so one can't be interested in science and not be in utter awe of how a single cell can churn to what we call a human being. And actually, that's when I'm operating on the heart and we hold it in our hands and stop it and fix it, I'm still humbled. One organ, only one.
Yeah.
Just the heart.
Yeah, and everything, and it doesn't even, well, I mean, it keeps other things going, but everything requires everything else. I mean, the network is really.
Right. And the human heart was designed by a great designer, I believe, a long time ago. It's never been, there's no Model 2. It's never been recalled.
It doesn't no 2.0.
doesn't get any periodic software updates.
You don't have to plug it in somewhere.
And it basically gets no maintenance its entire life. Yeah. It's the most efficient, energy-efficient pump on the face of the earth in terms of the energy consumed for work done. There is no mechanical pump designed that equals that.
Wow.
Anywhere.
And it all came from just, you know, slime in the... out the great beyond.
I'm sorry. As a scientist, I find that very unlikely.
Utterly impossible.
Very unlikely.
Yeah. See, I didn't take molecular biology, but I find that absolutely utterly impossible. Let's see. So you were UCLA Medical School. You let's get to the fun stuff. You did cardiac physiology research fellow for 2 years. You were UCLA cardiac and thoracic surgery fellowship. See, I did know how to say thoracic. That was good. Let's see. Oh, and then the Army.
That's
I had an interesting conversation with you about that. Okay, so U.S. Army Medical Corps active duty with the 101st Airborne Division, major promoted to lieutenant colonel. And all sorts of children's hospital and all things like that. But mm-hmm. we had an interesting conversation about your trip through the military and why you got involved. And I just thought maybe you'd be interested in sharing
Well, sure. I was in college during the Vietnam era. And actually, the war was peaking up. We got a deferment into medical school. And then as I was in the process of trying to be accepted for graduate surgical training, the training program at UCLA really wanted us. All of us had inherited an obligation from the Vietnam era because we had accepted deferments through college. So we were basically told that, okay, as you now graduate from medical school, let's plan your military service so that the people running the residency wouldn't have you suddenly pulled to active duty in the middle of it. So, and the Department of Defense was actually very interested in having surgeons, particularly surgeons, be fully trained. So they didn't want a bunch of partially trained surgeons. So it basically you had a program called the Berry Program, and basically if you applied for that, they would allocate you amongst the services, then commission you, not pay you. None of us had our education paid. It was just commissioned for a later date of entry upon completion of full training. So we, I proudly accepted a commission as a captain in the U.S. Army while I was at UCLA in a delayed entry date for active duty. Then as I finished the training, they made me a major, which is shocking. and then they were so short of surgeons, I was sent directly to the division. I never went to a day of basic training.
Wow.
So
directly to the front, huh?
Which explains why the doctors seem a little confused in MASH and other famous doctor stories, because we end up having very high rank. Because at that time, I had 12 years of professional training and exactly mm-hmm. what the military wanted for me, and I was a major. But I had never saluted anybody in my life.
That's pretty funny.
So there's a whole bunch of stories from
that. Did you guys goof off like they did in MASH?
Not quite the same. Nor we did not have hot lips or other.
Yeah, hairs, yeah.
Hollywood had
something. I wasn't even going there.
No, I was a surgeon. And
you had a lot of Frank Burns's, though.
It was a wonderful, challenging time, and I truly, while I had actually applied for a position in a big medical center doing heart surgery, they were sending all the new fully trained officers to line units, and that introduced me to a whole group of people and type of medicine I'd never experienced and would not turn back for a day. I mean, my best friend to this day is an aviator I met when we were in both duty. We were both majors. I always loved to fly, and I'd been a pilot with about 1,500 hours. And he was while an aviator, he always wanted to go to med school. So he would actually come and help me in the operating room, and I used to sign on and fly his crew. And he would put me with an instructor pilot. So that's how I learned how to fly Hueys and Cobras, partially. So,
fun.
Partially. You would, as a taxpayer, you would not want to give me a full aircraft solo. But
or be riding in it, or just...
Or be riding in it.
Yeah, okay.
But I didn't
good
crash. Killed no one. But I always had an instructor pilot. But my point is, the time of service with an all-volunteer unit like the 101st Airborne was
serve?
Great. Well, I was a reserve officer for 13 years.
Oh,
and then
wow.
A little over 2 years with the 101st active. And I'm proud of it, actually. They
be,
were wonderful, wonderful
and
people. And the men and women we were with were a good part of my life. I learned a lot from them. So,
well, thank you for your service.
Oh, sure.
Thank you very much. All right, we'll be right back.
Let me third that. Thank you for your service, Doctor.
Thank you.
But you know what?
You're welcome.
That is a big deal, because there were a lot of people weaseling out of it, and we talked about that, too, back in the day. I mean, you had a great ability to weasel out of it. You didn't take that.
I could have. There were lawyers that would convert doctors into conscientious objectors, and then you could weasel out of your commission. I chose not to because I promised.
Yeah. And that's awesome. And that just is a different kind of person, which is why you're on here instead of somebody who says, oh, yeah, I was in the Army and then I weaseled out of it.
And I would think that's exactly the kind of person that you would want to have holding your life in their hands.
Yeah, and fixing it. So let's see. I'll read the thing here. This is KCNR AM, 1460 AM, community radio for the North State. Apparently, you have to read this a few times before you get good at it.
That's government regulation.
If you want to call in, you've got to get with it. It's 530-605-4567. We'll be right back with you.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away.
Thank you, Bob. Are you talking about me?
Well, you did come with a white coat this morning.
There are some crazy people here.
You're just going to take us down a scary road today. Welcome back to We the People Radio, KCNR Community Radio, 1460 AM dial. Jump on the webpage at wethepeopleradio.us. We are talking about Obamacare. We got a nice little bio on our guest today, Dr. Doug McConnell. And you're kind of a local celebrity when it comes to keeping people apprised of what's really behind the health care mandates, the Affordable Care Act or the Unaffordable Care Act.
I can't even call it the Affordable Care Act. It's just so stupid.
I know.
Well, I'm not trying not to be a celebrity. I'm just trying to stay informed.
And
I think if I have a message to the audience today is we all need to be informed.
Mm-hmm.
This is don't sit back and be passive. This is your health care, not the government's.
Well, it was your health care.
Well,
now it's Kathleen Sebelius.
It's about your body and decisions in your family, and you know that I've. This is actually the my research into Obamacare, how its origins, what it consists of, and potentially where it's going, has led me to some bigger conclusions, a little broader philosophical, that we have to be very responsible about what is going on with our government. And the truth, just as you call we the people, mm-hmm. the American government was created out of a people movement, mm-hmm. or a populist movement against the greatest monarchy and power in the world. And it rose from people trying to redefine what their values were in their life and where it conflicted with the philosophy and the governments that they were found themselves caught up in as colonialists and distant from the government. And that basic tenet is really needs to be held in our memories,
yeah.
and react to where we are today. And that sort of just led me to say, well, okay, Obamacare is happening to me. Now, I've been a physician since 1971 when I took the Hippocratic Oath at graduation at UCLA. I've loved the profession and the patients and the position it gives you of trust. You earn your trust, but basically it's a honored profession generally, but particularly in what I do, I meet people under short circumstances, have to gain their trust in both my conversation and reassuring them that we can fix their loved one's problem, and then prove. I have to live on results. That means I'm accountable, to use a modern word. But basically, I live by producing. Your loved one will return to work and mm-hmm. be happy, and you'll be okay. And yes, these are the risks. It's not perfect, but we can be successful for you 97% of the time and get you back, and otherwise you're going to die.
Right.
So I have to prove that every day. I've been doing it since I started. And that's
true. No pressure there.
That's true of all physicians. We are held accountable to what we mm-hmm. basically claim we can accomplish.
Yeah, if you're a bad producer, you pretty much you get drummed out of the chorus.
In surgery, absolutely, you do. I mean, we're tested, and we try to prove ourselves every day. We're not perfect either by any means. But the point is we're quite accountable. Well, anyway, so since you love the profession and you're proud of what you do, and then along comes these various claims about us either not doing our fair share or we're not doing enough or, you know, it's unaffordable and this and that, you sort of look at your career and you begin to wonder, well, is this all true? You know, I started at UCLA as an R1, first-year resident, making $650 a month. And you knew that was going to be an 8-year journey as a resident to eventually become, you know, a qualified cardiac surgeon. And even when you're qualified, it still takes you another 10 years to get better or good. So it's a long journey. So it's a commitment. It's not a job. It's a vocation. So I'm proud. And most doctors that I know say, you know what, you know, it's not just, we didn't just sign up to go be a doctor. You don't just pick that course and then jump into
well,
it. It's a long, lifetime commitment.
And there's so much self-sacrifice.
Well, there is
in
the early years and even now. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I get a phone call at 4 in the morning.
Quality of life and time with family.
Oh, yeah. We won't go into all those details. I don't want anybody feeling sorry for me.
But
I think
but it isn't an 8-to-5 deal.
No.
And it isn't something that you get on the job training.
No. There's a lot we do learn.
No, but it's not the kind of career you fall into. I mean, it's very purposeful.
It's a vocation.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it's in your soul. At least for good docs that I know and that I trained with and the guys I knew in the Army. You care about being a physician. Okay, now fast forward to Obamacare. I was always confused about Obamacare, and I've known medicine's been changing for a lot of years, from the time Medicare was enacted through my residency to the end of the residency, military, and then my 28 years in Long Beach, I watched things change as we went through PPOs, then HMOs, and a variety of – began really under President Nixon, if you really go back to this, where we wanted to create whole new models of the delivery of health care. Those were the terms, and it began in the 70s, under Republican president. Where they put federal money into creating new business constructs called what we called HMO. And one of the biggest ones in the nation was right in Long Beach, which was Family Health Plan, FHP. Eventually became FHP, then became other things. But that was all federally subsidized as to create a new business model that they hoped would take off.
Well, that's what you want, the federal government behind a business model.
Well, that's what they did in the HMO Act in the early, mid-70s before Nixon left office. So you really have to point the origin of where we are to back to this idea that you could create a business construct that would somehow alter the, what was the open market and save money. If you look at healthcare costs and insurance policy rates, everything's only gone up almost proportional to the amount of federal involvement and regulatory control and modeling and fiddling, as I call it, from that day forward. When I finished my residency at UCLA, my granddad had to come in for surgery, and I think the hospital day rate at UCLA in 1977 for a regular room was $55. And I could give him the pavilion, which was the private rooms with carpet and their own cook and everything on the upper floor for $95. So when he came in for his surgery, I forked over the difference between Medicare would pay for the $55 a day room, and I forked over the $40 to give him the upgrade. And he came in for his operation. That was 1978. Now, there were all these other charges because you were charged, but it was not a flat rate. But that was the honest-to-God Medicare rate at UCLA per day for a bed room was $55, approximately that. Anyway, the rest is history. And healthcare has changed as response as the feds have gotten more and more involved in it. And in fact, I'm pretty certain that one could claim that a modest amount of, or a fair amount of, what we call the exceedingly high cost of healthcare is directly related to the federal interventions, regulations, and standardization that goes into healthcare as well as in the pharmaceutical industry, which drive up the cost of every product we have. We now have drug shortages in the United States of things we use in heart surgery. In fact, I got a call from a pharmacist that, you know, we're down to our two vials of this, so should we reschedule? We worked it out fine. But the truth is, the United States, because the FDA fiddling in their issue of patient safety and all the things there, have actually driven manufacturers to close down plants and retool to FDA guidelines on drugs that are as simple as sodium bicarbonate, which is not a glamour drug.
I was at CVS last night, and they were down to their last thing of estrogen.
Okay.
Wow. Are you kidding me?
Well,
you know?
They said we
run out of this all the time. You probably want to fill this right now.
Well, and so this is interesting
stupid
in the United States. And well, these are generally non-glamour drugs in the sense that they're not on patent. And so companies are just doing it with a small margin. But if their costs of doing business are brought up by regulatory control, they're going to drop their small margin products and go for the ones that with a big margin.
On the shortages of drugs, is that primarily generics or name brands? Or both?
Well, there are classes of drugs which are hard to get. There's currently a list, and not being a pharmacist, but I've heard there's as many as 250 drugs which are on a short supply list. And so there is now a whole industry coming up of almost a black market, gray market of secondary drugs. Anyway, that's really not what I wanted to go today. What I'm going to try to say is that when the marketplace is being disrupted by federal influence, it doesn't work out well for us at all. Here's my epiphany that happened just this week, and I knew Aaron would want to hear this. I was always trying to place Obamacare into some bigger context. What drives this? Why health care? I'll get to Obamacare in a second. And I came across this absolutely wonderful book by Thomas Sowell. And if, part of being educated as an American today, I believe, is to read Thomas Sowell's website, S-O-W-E-L-L, or get his books. Run to the bookstore and get it, or get your Kindle out. But this man, who has the wonderful ability, because he's also an African-American academic economist, so he's sheltered from all the petty charges of racism whenever he brings up a thesis that's contrary to the current administration. So he has been able to speak his mind. In addition, there's a gentleman named Walter Williams, who's similar in the sense that he is was the former chairman of economics at George Mason University. These are two of the clearest thinking, logical, academic economists I have ever read in my life.
I have Thomas Sowell's book, Economics.
Me too.
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Big white one.
But on his website, he will lead you to some great columns, but also a book on his analysis of the housing crisis.
Mm.
Now, this is not Obamacare. But
that would be good.
But what was the name of the act that set up what we went through in 2006? And the book is the whole dissection of exactly why we had a housing boom and bust in the United States. And he lays the blame directly on the federal government's mucking up the free market of mortgage industry and the housing industry. Mm-hmm. And he has the proof. It's in the book. It's irrefutable. It's so logically presented. He names names of congressmen who were basically involved in doing this. And I'm not sure you could call yourself an American if you don't bother to read this and then come to the bigger understanding of exactly how the federal government screws up our economy. And I'm not a crazy guy. I'm not a conspiratist. I'm an applied scientist.
But you do have a white coat.
Well, I do have a white coat. Yeah, thank you. But as I began to read Thomas Sowell, I began to see the bigger picture. And now this has changed my thinking. So I suggest this book. But it all goes back to an act passed in Jimmy Carter's era. And what was the name of that? Well, it's the Community Reinvestment Act, CRA. But that led to an entire plan within the Democratic Party and became very popular in Washington as a great thing, and it was called affordable housing. What's the name of our Patient Care Act that you and I are talking about? The
affordable
health care. Yeah, so the link in my mind suddenly is that perhaps well-thinking and perhaps well-intended people suddenly get a bee in their bonnet that there's a need to make something affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever a government decides to do that, they're talking about getting into the market and somehow fiddling with either some portion of the supply or demand or price fixing.
And and picking their winners and losers.
Price fixing is the key.
And Nixon began. That was Nixon's whole thing. He had price fixing back in his era. And Nixon started mucking around with health care, with HMOs, to make it affordable. So anyway, if you follow this beginning train of thought, and that's where Thomas Sowell ties it
together.
Now,
what's the name of the book?
It's, I think, The Housing Crisis.
The Housing Crisis, okay.
Yeah, it's in the title. I should have the title right with me. I apologize.
That's okay. We'll
but
look it up.
But Thomas Sowell,
yeah,
please do. Because what he does is he really tracks it back, and the same forces, exactly the same forces, the same intentions that basically gave us the economic crisis, which is we are still suffering through as a nation, are exactly at play in healthcare. And healthcare is about as central to a family's existence as is housing. And as I read this book, I suddenly said, oh, that's the link. This is all about trying to ultimately legislate the marketplace into creating something that a group of well-thinking politicians have designed where we need to go, like affordable health care.
Mm-hmm.
And there's your name of your book.
But who decides what's affordable?
Right.
That's
well,
the kicker
and for,
at how
and
we
for who.
Get there.
How
and
can
for who.
You make something affordable except to have a free marketplace where you outproduce and manage what's done and deal with the incentives that are run by the end consumer, not by the middle person?
Yeah, competition always drives it. Well, you start looking at, look at our utility bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, PG&E's got us. So PG&E is going to be raising their rates soon. And I'm sorry, what were our choices? Oh, yeah, zero.
Yeah, PG&E is a government monopoly.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Sowell's book, if this is the one you're talking about, is called The Housing Boom and Bust.
Yes, that's the book. And I recommend that to everybody.
Right
and even though I'm here talking about health care,
we were talking about the whole thing. It's a whole big picture. You can't talk about health care without this whole picture.
His thesis is that politicians in both parties, by the way, he's right down the middle guy, both politicians are shielded from the results or the accountabilities of their actions because they always can find someone to blame outside of Washington for whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the great myth right now is that somehow the greedy Wall Street people, who, by the way, had a part of this, were the cause of this. No, they were not. It was the federal government changed the market rules and forced Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to basically buy subprime loans.
Mm-hmm. Because everyone deserved a house.
Well.
Because it's a right. and just like health care is a right, supposedly.
And
now,
you can't, as Thomas Sowell points out, in the world of economics, you can't basically favor one group without disfavoring and hurting someone else. And if the consumer end is being favored, now you're suppressing the producers. And if you don't have production, the price has to rise.
That's right. And all on that note,
we better take a swift break here. We'll be behind the eight ball. All right, you're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR 1460 AM, community radio for the North State.
I called my doctor on the telephone. Help me, doctor, something's wrong. I can't shake it, it's gone too far. Said, tell me what your symptoms are.
Can you mend the broken up?
He's got a coat and a hat.
Where are your gloves?
They're coming.
We're here at the Ice Palace.
The Ice Queens.
All right, hit it, Elizabeth.
Okay. The sun needs to shine in here. It's a little chilly.
We like it that way, though.
So you are listening to We the People Radio with Bob Martin, Elizabeth Woodward, Aaron Ryan, and our special guest, Dr.
I'm
Doug
thrilled.
McConnell.
I finally got the control room too cold.
Yes, that's wonderful, Bob.
People
thank
here
you very much.
not for us, though. See, we're so good. But I thought the operating room was cold, aren't you?
Well, it is, but we're wearing three layers of clothes in there.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, you had me stripped down to my... No.
Yeah, we brought him in.
Yeah, no, we're...
That's why this is radio.
Oh, you guys wear big clothes in there?
Well, we have our scrubs, then you have waterproof paper gowns that cover you from head to toe.
Right.
Rubber gloves, and you're covered by that, so you don't have a lot of...
Lights on you.
Yes. Yeah, big lights. Oh, so, so you don't have a lot of evaporative surface.
And a lot of bodies in the room.
Close. Yeah, yeah. Standing very close to each other, which is why I went to surgery. But that's a separate story.
Now we see he warms up a little.
As a young boy, he's like, "Hey, this is a good idea.
I could stand really close to cute nurses."
That is funny. Yes. So his wife's like, "Hey, get off it."
So we're talking big picture here. We were talking about.
I did have a question here.
Oh, from the chat room.
Okay.
Yeah, from the chat room.
Far away.
From my dad, who was a recipient of care such as yours years ago. He says, in the big picture, what's the single most harmful part of Obamacare to the general population?
And is that financial or medical?
Yes.
Does it matter?
Well, from what you've seen.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking it's a very fair question.
So we don't necessarily have to answer it right this minute. Maybe we can percolate on that. But that is a question that came through, and I thought, coalescing on the tip of the spear, I guess.
I do. I think the truth is the delivery arm of Obamacare is, I think, very paper construct. It's an organization chart. In Canada, years ago, the Supreme Court came out with a very important ruling. Canada had this great system for health care, meaning that it looked good on paper and they had dollars apportioned to it, but they had no providers. And the Supreme Court in Canada came to the point and said, we're sorry, but a position on a waiting list is not health care.
In other words, that's nice.
Good thinking.
Having the infrastructure in present. Oh, we got hospital beds, and we got this, and we got that, and you got a clinic over here, and we're building a new building. That's all great. But if you don't have the learned person with a skill set and licensure that's actually going to take care of your neurosurgical need or your orthopedic need, what good is all that? And so what isn't well thought out of and constrained, and in our discussion we'll talk about the actual delivery. Who's going to do things? Where are you going to have your next generation of heart surgeons like me? I'll give you numbers from my field, which I know, and these represent others, but each year the United States has about 106 people who finish training as a cardiac surgeon. That's it, in the whole country. So it's 106 residencies. And you
really?
You enter that and then you exit.
Wow.
It's pretty limited. There's whole states that don't train any cardiac surgeons when you think about it.
Really?
Well, there's no training program in Wyoming that I'm aware of, or Idaho, or Montana, or South Dakota. But there are at Mayo Clinic. There's two a year, maybe.
Wow.
Cleveland Clinic may have
so
three
how
or four.
Many, do you have any idea how many heart surgeons are in practice?
Well, I could get you those numbers, but first off, age, I think the average age, mean age right now, I think is about 56 of the entire cardiac surgeons in the United States.
Sure. So we've got more. We'll have more guys retiring than obviously we're feeding in from the other end.
Well, let me finish. 106 residencies for which there were only 81 applicants last year, I was told.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you.
So no one's going into these fields because their future of being an employee of a nebulous organization or a government entity is so bleak. Who would want to take? It's an 8-year commitment after medical school to become a cardiac surgeon, and then begin an additional 8 years to get good. So where's the supply going to be for the ever-growing baby boom generation if you don't have? And I'm just giving you cardiac thoracic surgeons.
Sure, but that's a biggie.
Yeah,
and that isn't necessarily. I mean, I'm sure some people get to plan for that, you know. Mm-hmm. Hey, you've got a problem. You need to be in here in a few days, maybe.
But I mean, for surgery. Well,
yeah, but my guess is most people, it's a pretty short turnaround, isn't it?
Well,
or they have a heart attack and you got to operate.
As cardiac surgery is, we can do more and more in the world of cardiology and cardiac surgery. You now need the presence of a cardiac surgeon to back up a cath lab to do the stenting, for example. So we're sort of the enabling force. We're also part of the emergency team, meaning just when you take off at airport LAX or uh-huh. Long Beach, wherever, there, you always go right by a big airport fire department. Sitting there with tankers and pumpers. Well, they're there. They keep the airport open. They may not be needed every flight, but they're part of making the airport work. And there's a certain class of airports that can't be unless they have a fire department on the field. And and then how about neurosurgeons and trauma centers and orthopedists and so forth? So there's a lot of very high-end specialists that are absolutely needed to deliver health care. And they're never going to be replaced by PAs or nurse practitioners. It's really not within their world of training or licensure, at least at this date, for the nurse practitioner to pick up a scalpel and go enter an abdominal cavity or try to fix some traumatic event. They certainly practice good medicine in clinics and do primary care screening and manage general care. But there's this whole segment of high-end, high-tech, highly invasive medicine, or even the high-end cardiology of, you know, mapping inside of the heart for arrhythmia control. All that's going to be done by a cadre of highly trained physicians that somehow took on a 6, 8, 10-year commitment to learn this. Well, what if they stop entering the training programs?
Mm-hmm. So the 100 or the 80 some people that are not maxing mm-hmm. out, the guys that are coming in, we're creating, you know, that we have this shortage
yes.
being
well, right now
feeding in from the bottom.
Right now, I think within the next 12 years, the American, it's this. I can't recall the exact group, but they're in charge of all the training programs in the United States. It's a private association of all the medical centers that train residents. They're predicting a $40,000 doctor shortage within about 12 years.
Wow.
No one's,
So it won't be a bubble that bursts. It'll be more like a...
leaking?
Well, yeah, a little poof of dust.
Somewhere after this all gets starts... somebody will bring suits. There's about, you promised me this and that, but there's no doctors in my town or this or that. And then they have a suit. Well, it's now a governmental system. And maybe our Supreme Court will come out with a decision. Yes, you know, thank you, U.S. government, but a place on a waiting list place to get knee surgery 300 miles away is hardly health care. But it is provider driven.
And we've got a caller on the line that we'll get back to as soon as we come back from this break.
Yep.
Sorry to keep you on hold.
We'll talk.
Sorry, BC, we'll be right back with you. We're going to take a swift break here at We the People Radio. Check us out online, wethepeopleradio.us. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM, Community Radio for the North State.
You can never know what it's like. Your blood like winter freezes just like ice. And there's a cold and lonely light that shines from you. You wind up like the wreck you hide behind that mask you use. Did you think this fool could never win? Well, look at me, I'm coming back again. I got a taste of love in a simple way. And if you need to know while I'm still standing, you just fade away. Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did? Looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid. Picking up the pieces of my life.
Welcome back. Hey, we're going to jump right onto the telephone, bring in BC. He's been holding for quite a while to talk to Dr. Doug McConnell. Are you there, BC?
I sure am. Good morning, Aaron.
Thanks for holding on.
We love our phone hostages.
Question, do you think this is going to create a huge cottage industry in the medical profession of people that will want to be medical doctors, good ones, and just but have to go through and all the costs and the time and the involvement to be good doctors, that it'll be offshore to where we'd be headed?
Well,
because of the money exchange thing. I think right now you could go to New Zealand with a Da Vinci open heart bypass, 6 weeks, plane fare and everything for $58,000. So is this where it's going to hit? All the good doctors will kind of have an exodus and go somewhere else where the exchange rate makes it worthwhile to be a doctor?
Well, there's several questions in that. The answer is already there are some havens being set up for plastic surgery in northern Mexico and so forth, basically exiting the constraints. I don't know all those details. And there are actually some interesting competing international centers for cardiac surgery and orthopedic surgery in various countries, India included. And I'm not familiar with their outcomes and expertise, but the facilities are absolutely quite gorgeous. So the answer is yes. Also within the United States, you may develop a group of concierge physicians, especially primary care and internal medicine doctors, who basically choose to just accept paying patients who are willing to pay for access. At the moment, we don't have any sense that the government's going to forbid private practice. They did do that in Canada. There's no
right.
The Canadian system ended up with just government medicine, no private practice.
The scary part to me is that and there's a lot of wealthy people who retire. I mean, there's 10,000 a day on the baby boomers. There's a lot of them that have money. And with these places being set up, the really good doctors are going to be there because that just makes common sense.
Yes, they may.
Get this up.
Yeah, they may be. And interestingly, New Zealand has its own nationalized healthcare system. So I'm unfamiliar with the New Zealand business that you're talking about. But also the driving some of this in the American medicine is we have a displaced cost as to what things. Displaced ideas to what things really cost because you see hospital bills, but there's really no bypass surgery in the United States where someone's making $58,000 off an insurance company or the federal government for bypass, mm-hmm. even though you'll see bills of 90 and 80, 100,000 mm-hmm. printed. That's one of the big problems in our healthcare system is that we got into this bizarre pricing, create a bill type arrangement, which I'm not going to go in here today, but people
they're not even readable. You can't even understand them.
That is correct. I think the hospital industry needs to look deep into its own soul as to how we got to where we are on that. But what that did do is take the consumer or the end user out of the equation in some sort of a free market, because you look at these bills and you say that can't be true. And the hospitals know very well what it costs them to do a routine or elective coronary artery bypass surgery and what the profit should or could be. That said, they have all these unknowns, often coming from the government, as to what services they have to provide for patients that have no income whatsoever.
Right.
So,
what you have
is a free market totally blown apart by mm-hmm. legalisms and federal regulation and state and local regulation. So consequently, you've destroyed the private market or any tool that your mind might use to try to make a rational financial decision on what's going to cost. And the insurance companies like you to be confused, the government likes you to be confused, and the hospitals sort of have to go along with the other two confusing people. So consequently, you have confusion and chaos. And that's really why we have a perfect crisis for the government to come in and say, let me separate this all out and help you make it affordable. And that's where we all jump off the cliff together, and that's where you got to read Thomas Sowell.
Well, it's certainly scary for us older people. That's what we're going to be facing. So anyhow, I'll get off here and let somebody else come in.
All right, thanks, BC.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Thanks, BC. Have a good morning. Hey, we're going to come back with you guys. We've got 5 minutes of news here coming up really quickly before
I'll stay because
you have to stay.
Oh, I did?
That wasn't optional.
I signed up for just an hour.
No. We had you on the
whole deal.
Yeah, no one turns these leaves.
I don't know what I told
Clara. I'm
going to
run through the door and lock it.
All right. Will do.
He'll have to get past you if he's got his airborne hat on.
Yeah.
You guys, you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. The chat room's up and alive. You can call in after the first of the hour at 530-605-4567. Oh.
Welcome back. Hopefully you got a hot cup of steaming coffee and did whatever you need to do in a five-minute break. You are joining We the People Radio at KCNR Community Radio for the North State. I know that that's not my job to say that, but it's just kind of fun to do something different.
Really? I find it irritating because I kind of like the old. I like to just rattle it off and be done.
I like change.
I like change, too. I don't know. My mouth was all ready to do the other one.
So if you're just tuning in, we are talking healthcare today with Dr. Doug McConnell. Obamacare, government intervention such as it is, or intrusion from the federal government and its direct impact on cost.
So how much do you like change when it comes to that?
Not much.
Yeah, see? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, change has become a dirty word
in my vocabulary. It's all about where your change is.
Hey, so I'm curious, for the average family, how is Obamacare going to impact them, let's say, in the next 10 years, if you can look down the road that far? And I'm talking a family with children.
Well, there's various metrics to use. Yeah. I've seen one recently where they expect the actual cost of health care insurance, they being, I think, the industry, to rise to $1,500, $2,000 extra over current costs. There's nothing is going to get cheaper under Obamacare that I can see with the health care exchanges. The states are still flailing around with their architecture for what will become the state exchange. I think ours was just approved last week, and that means there's a document that's approved. And I think it's very important. I think your question's correct, but you have to really realize Obamacare, as passed, is a 2,300-page bill that has some immediate effects, namely taxes and new charges and challenges to states to set up exchanges mm-hmm. so that people can have access to self-purchased or subsidized insurance plans of some sort based on federally defined, this is what you got to cover, items. So that's part of it. But the rest of Obamacare is like looking at a skyscraper being built where the entire metal framework exists in the sky, you know, but there's no floors in. It's just, you're looking through it. It's authority for a variety of new committees and responsibilities and reporting accountabilities. It's brand new authorities for revenue streams. But the taxes are very much defined in there. And they're going to affect this 1913. And they're going to affect every working American in the United States.
We already see so many large companies reducing their employees' hours to part-time so they don't have to cover their health care.
You also have all the companies that make medical devices being hit with a tax just because they're making medical devices. It's a separate thing. And that's a 3% tax that's going to feed right through the system. I mean, any tax in the United States ultimately feeds down to the
consumer,
sure. The purchaser of insurance, or the hospital director or manager who has to pass on the cost. There is no free lunch in – when one says affordable, you're going to either have to suppress costs or take monies from somebody or some entity and redistribute it. Oh, wait a minute. That's what we do. So the point is that our health care is going to grow in bureaucracy. So how will affect an average family, let's say a family that currently has insurance through their employer mm-hmm. or their own employer, it's going to be more expensive. Would be my first case. The real question is, will there be providers? Will there be physicians? Mm-hmm. So in your case, how many pediatricians are going to still be able to stay in solo practice and be the pediatricians? Or are they going to be forced into what the government's creating called ACOs, Accountable Care Organizations? It already sounds jargon-esque, doesn't it?
Sure
but
does.
That is the new business.
You need an acronym for everything.
That's the new business model that they are basically hatching out of the Obamacare legislation. Is they want doctors to form large groups to take on risk, you know, sort of become internally insured, that they take a panel of patients, and the government will either increase or decrease their reimbursement based upon how efficient they are in giving out the care. Now, that sounds great if you're some sort of macroeconomist, mm-hmm. but a doc just sees you and your sick son. mm-hmm. that time.
That's why you go to a doctor.
That is correct. It's
they're not their business. Yeah, they're not out there managing their group.
And that responsibility as a physician is what's driven us as a profession, that ultimately when I have a patient, I work for one person. I'm my own boss, but I am taking care of, well, like the 85-year-old guy I took care of yesterday. Now, Medicare may be paying his bill to me eventually. I never check insurance. I've never, actually, I think I'm proud of this. In all my years, I've never asked anybody, are you insured or not insured? Who are you insured with? Never have, whether it's a patient in the ER at Long Beach where I was, or a child in the children's hospital. Sometimes they're just, but they're children and they need care. So, but the point is that I only work for that patient and he's my boss. He probably has a wife and family. So my job is to do what he needs medically, and it's very clear who I work for. Now you start changing where the patient belongs to the organization, and he's a panel, and you got a manager that's looking for efficiencies. How do we change this? Do you get to see the same pediatrician, or are they going to have mm-hmm. a panel of people, and
sure.
do they last, or they move them around?
And are you talking to him too long in the
all of that?
All that stuff.
Accountable care organization is the model. It's really, I think, HMOs reborn. And HMOs didn't go well with the knowledgeable consumers, at least not all. Some do, some work pretty well, but the general local HMO was a challenge to most knowledgeable consumer patients in the United States. But the ACO is a rebirth of that with a little different spin and internal constructs. But it's really about the government trying to price fix both the services of the physicians and change access, which is the way you save money. So I think healthcare insurance you're going to buy is going to be through the organizations, and you're going to have to get your care maybe through an ACO. That's going to be a different model than people are mm-hmm. used to. So I think that's one big effect. But I can't give you an estimate on that because nothing's really done. Really, Obamacare is about setting up these new taxes where the revenue is coming in now. And the rules and how is it really going to work on day-to-day are nice thoughts in their set of rules that are out there that are yet to be fulfilled. And it's one thing, as we know, for the government to define a construct and to actually have it deliver on the
surface. And you've got to ask yourself, all these taxes and revenue streams that they're going to start collecting, are they really going to apply toward healthcare, or are they going to just be dumped into the general fund like everything else?
Well, that's a fair question. I don't know. You mean like somehow Social Security dollars actually get sidetracked?
Like mm-hmm.
Yeah, they disappear into. We're left with Treasury bills, which used to be good, but the question is, where are we going in the future? Will other nations honor our Treasury bills, and or we're going to have to pay them?
Mm-hmm. And they probably know what we know, and
well, they might. But I think there is. But I think the other
we also have a caller on the line.
Sorry,
comment.
Okay. Oh, Don,
good. I was
sorry
just
going
to get
that.
To a good piece of trivia, but
this is actually
hold.
A great segue.
Oh, forget the trivia.
Okay,
we got a hostage on the line.
All right,
morning, Don.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. I think that the basic meaning is abomination there, but. Don't you think you're going to have a supervising physician and several PAs underneath them? And we need some kind of care for the people who are uninsured. What do you think we need to do to change this so we get our care, to pay for it? It's just so complicated.
Okay. Don, let me address that first part that I should have made myself clear on this point early on. Obamacare, as we know it, has really been 20 years in the making. Obama happened to be president and fertilized the last little bit of it. But the truth is, this has been going on for 20 years in the mind of the professional bureaucrats that make up the healthcare structure in Washington. So don't think that Obama, who took office in January of 2009, was able to produce a 100-page bill that gets passed and through the legislative process in the fall of 2009 and into law in 2010. That basically, all those pieces have been percolating in the system for years and were assembled and put into Obamacare so quickly that no one had a chance to read it. So he certainly was a great proponent of doing it, but the Democratic and the professional bureaucracies that, we're fully supportive of this, and you got to realize some of the demonstration projects that made up what I was just talking about, the ACOs, really began under George Bush. So this is not a Democratic Obama thing only. One has to look at this is the very nature of the federal government's process of defining areas into which it sees a problem and then tries to create well-intentioned regulation and alteration of the free market.
Do you really think they're well-intentioned? Or does that depend on individual legislator?
Well, the legislators are the last to know. It's the bureaucracies that define a need for their expansion of services. Okay,
are they defining the need for their jobs?
Well, ultimately they are. But the truth is the legislators know very little about Medicare, really, of the needs. But you have bureaucracies seeing these needs. They do the regional studies. They have the bubble-ups. And then they come up and they'll have a liaison on Medicare issues with certain members of a committee in Congress. And then they'll start talking about CMS, the Center for Medicare Services, needs this, or they're suggesting this. And then it sort of takes flight. But if it's under the guise of making things affordable or more efficient or better, cheap, whatever, it takes traction and it goes on from there. But I just didn't want to negate the second part of Don's thing, this question. Yes, there will be a whole raft of physician extenders supported because demand is going to go up. When you put 40 million people that have been on the fringes of centralized health care, or so they claim, frankly, many were getting care, and you push them into the system, you're going to have more providers of some sort. And this is where their model breaks down. Yes, you will create and train new PAs, or physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners who are excellent at what they do in their field. But that doesn't mean you're going to have neurosurgeons or orthopedists or cardiac surgeons because they don't come out of that mold. There's no pathway from PA to becoming a cardiac surgeon or replacing a heart valve solo. I work with a wonderful PA one-on-one every day. But legally, there's no way that individual to do heart surgery. Now, he's actually capable of it. But legally, there's no way to do it. And you have to back up and start medical school to ever get to that goal.
What about some of these folks? There was a question earlier that somebody wanted to know, will these physicians be able to stay in private practice? Or will they have to be attached to a group or a hospital? Because a GP that we deal with said there's no way. Like, there are people out there who will say, well, they could just work privately and work for cash. They could work outside the insurance system. Well, but that's actually against the law with this.
I don't know that to be true, Aaron. That's certainly the case in Canada, where it was made illegal to have a private practice. Britain, ultimately, to insure satisfaction with his patients, England, had to basically open that up after they had a government system only. It didn't last long before they had to allow private practice so that there's a free market on the side to handle the demand.
Okay, because this guy's private practice now, and he said, well, if I wanted to just step outside the Obamacare loop, remain in private practice as a GP, and just take patients on a cash basis and do it that way, because people have said, you know what, I'll pay the fine and I'll just come to you anyway and I'm just not going to have it. He's like, I can't treat you. not going to be allowed. So I don't know if it's by specialty or if it's...
As of law today, a physician can step out of Medicare, but it's a big deal. You have to announce it at certain 2 months of the year. You have to do this. And then you accept no more Medicare payments for any of your patients. And you have to bill every one of them. And then the patient bills Medicare for reimbursement. And there are neurosurgeons that have done that up in Canada.
And
Washington
I would imagine
State.
That a patient
so
that
it's,
would...
If you could do it, people, it will happen. Pediatricians, right? There are people that really, I have no idea that Obamacare is going to address what we call Obamacare address. Remember my big term, Obamacare.
Sure. Like
that Affordable Care Act, what does it do with plastic surgery and elective surgery and plastic surgery where people just, it's purely cosmetic? That's still a cash business. And it will continue to be my guess.
All right.
It's not covered by insurance now.
Well, that's true. Thanks for your question, Don.
Thanks, Don. Keep driving. He's on his way here.
I think he's gone.
He's still driving. His program starts at 10.
That's right. Don and Judy, 10 to noon, Sundays on AM 1460.
What are they chatting about today? Do we know? Give him a shameless plug.
Okay, shameless plug time. Yes, I believe Don said he's got For the Love of Pies representatives to visit with us this morning.
I know that little place.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hopefully they'll bring free samples.
If you're listening, you still have time.
Because it's not pie the math, it's pie the food.
That's right. Dr. McConnell was not allowed to bring free samples, by the way, just in case you're wondering.
Well, I've got some great trivia to come up
with. All right, we're going to come back with Dr. Doug McConnell here on We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, community radio for the North State.
I'll keep my freedom. I'll keep my guns. Try to keep my money and my religion, too. Try to keep on working. Try to keep on smiling. I will keep my Christian name, and y'all can keep the change.
Doctor, can't you see I'm burning, burning?
Very good, Bob.
Doctor, I got a billion of them.
Good. Yeah, give me your collection. That's cute. Thank you.
Yeah, he's awesome.
You have some MASH bump music here coming up? You can do that.
Ooh, yeah.
Ooh, good suggestion.
Yes. Yeah. You have 9 minutes. So you are joining We the People Radio.
We take bumper music requests.
Okay.
530-605-4567.
There you go. And we're with Dr. Doug McConnell. So you have some trivia there.
Well, I do. I just want a brief moment on this construct. We were making the point about really Obamacare, as it sits, is this 26-page foundation and framework that's going to be filled in by years, literally years, of regulations and then case law, which will begin to define what we really call. And it does take a long time. Referencing back to Thomas Sowell, to the Accountable Community Reinvestment Act, CRA, it wasn't until the Clinton administration where the Justice Department used the tools of that act and came after banks and made them decide to create mortgages on racial preference and quotas in the United States of America. Quotas were applied to the mortgage market industry, beginning to change the makeup of how we did business, and the rules of the previously fairly conservative rules were destroyed by the federal government.
It didn't have anything to do with your credit.
Right.
It wasn't a standalone thing on your finances.
There was a FHA, well, it's in his book, FHA study that was published erroneously about the mortgage denial rate amongst various ethnic groups in the United States. They left out Asians, in which only 3-4% were denied. Caucasians were 12%, and African Americans was 36%. The bottom line is that the majority of all loans were approved. I don't want to get into all the details of that, but what he said was, in an attempt to adjust the what was perceived as an issue of fairness, they destroyed the soundness of the American investing principles. And it took from about 1993, 1994 to 2006 to run its course. And in the process, or 2008, we destroyed the American economy, or nearly did, or maybe so. We don't know. But again, it starts, so it's years later. And what we have here in Obamacare is really just the same nidus that we'll have case law and justice departments of the future referring back to issues that have yet to be defined in good detail. And it's very important that you understand that no one in Congress read this bill. Now, this is a problem I have, and Nancy Pelosi told you that. You have to pass it to know what's in it. What she really means is we pass ideas, and then the bureaucracy creates the actual implementation.
And figures out how to do it.
And then they bend it to what they think the intention of the Congress was. I mean, Congress passes ideas that are fed to them by bureaucrats. They say, oh, that sounds good. We're going to make health care affordable, and we'll set up exchanges. Isn't that nice? We'll do that. That's good. We have insurance exchanges for bad drivers. Let's do that with drug addicts. I mean, let's get them into the insurance system.
Yeah.
But they don't know how it's going to work out. What the hell? But, you know, we'll pass it. We'll see how it goes. That's really sort of the attitude.
Well, because people deserve it.
Well, here's my problem.
Everybody has to have it, and so we're going to make everybody have it.
Yes.
One size will fit all.
Healthcare is not a right. It's a privilege.
Or else.
In my book. It's a privilege to provide it, and it's a privilege to get it.
So do you think this law is constitutional? As written.
I don't think the mandate, per se, is. I think that was heavily debated. I think Congress is allowed to No, I really don't, because I think it disrupts a segment of a free market. It's become very American, but no, it's not constitutional.
They had to declare it a tax instead of a mandate in order for it to be considered constitutional. That was what
Justice Roberts
came up with when he did 180 in the middle of his delivery.
That's correct. I mean, but more importantly, I think it's silly because there won't be anybody to provide the health care. Who's going to basically be your neurosurgeon of the future, given what may come out of this?
Yeah.
And here's the real fiddling. It takes you a decade to recover from that mistake. You don't legislate a neurosurgeon. I don't come up to you and say, oh, Aaron, we're short a neurosurgeon. You do that.
Thou shalt be.
Right. I mean, so this is when the government has consequences it doesn't understand, that it gets into this. And I think they did this. They didn't read it. Now, I know for a fact that if I practiced or did heart surgery on someone and wasn't prepared and hadn't looked at the angiograms and didn't plan the operation out to every detail in my head and with my team, I'd be guilty of malpractice. Absolutely stonely guilty. And there'd be no defense if I just showed up and said, oh, hell, I didn't see the angiograms. And, it was an aortic valve. Was that a mitral? Oh, I don't know. No. I don't know why we, the citizens, can't sue people we pay for mal-legislation, except they're protected by law. But damn it, there's got to be a standard of care for what it means to be a legislator and reading and understanding the knowledge and taking the wisdom you're supposed to have and looking at what the challenge is and then deciding what makes sense is job one. And if you haven't read this and you're just being fed the analysis of it by a bunch of 26-year-old staffers who are 3 years, 4 years out of some college, we're in trouble. And that's really what's going on as a purely functional here. And we have an insight in here to this process that truly very little is understood by our legislators, I believe. It's certainly the Speaker of the House didn't have any idea what's going on. So, but I also want to talk with Obamacare. It's part of a perfect storm. And again, I use the I should just call it the Affordable Care Act, because I clearly say Republican administrations and bureaucrats going all the way back into even in the Reagan era, there were things that were happening in these departments that didn't get stopped. So it goes back to Jimmy Carter, Reagan, Bush the senior, right through Clinton's, where it got a lot of support out of the Justice Department, into Bush the junior, and now Obama came along and said, oh, man, this is all ready to go. But here's the other part of this storm that is going to destroy healthcare as we know it. Is there something called the ICD-10, which is a World Health Organization push from the UN that's come into and is now being forced down the entire medical profession's throats. And this is the coding process by which this is the other side of what's going on here. So they want to measure the productivity of physicians and hospitals using a coding system for events, treatments, and location of injury that is going from around 16,000 codes to about 70,000 or 120. And now they expect us to know these things. And I brought a couple of them here so that your listeners can really understand this other dimension that is now being forced at a time we're trying to basically provide efficient care. You will not get reimbursed by any insurance company or by Medicare unless you are able to code. I'm going to give you a couple examples of location of injury to this level of detail. Now, here are two codes that I just randomly picked out of this. These are injury locations, like where was this patient injured? So your emergency room is going to have to code why this guy's in your ER. Here's one, code V02.11XA. Pedestrian on roller skates injured in collision with a two- or three-wheeled motor vehicle in traffic accident.
That's on odd-numbered Thursday.
Yeah, well, that's now, that's a different code if you're injured by a four-wheel vehicle. And it's a different code if you're not on roller skates. There's a separate code for skateboards. Absolutely. They have decided, they being, in this case, to come up with the most arcane, the overhead and the coders and the personnel you'll need to feed the beast now that we're going to electronic is enormous. Here's another code. Yeah. You'll love this one. V902XA. Drowning and submersion due to falling or jumping from burning water skis, comma, initial encounter.
So you've got to get the right code.
Was there a rash of that happening somewhere?
Yes.
Was this a bit, this is a big problem?
This is real. And the point is this.
Burning water skis?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll read it again. Drowning and submersion due to falling or jumping from burning water skis, initial encounter. If it's your second time in, it's a different code. I have no idea how many times people fall from burning water skis, but that's a code. And I'm doing this because there's also a series of codes if you're on a, if it's a injury on a farm.
Is this new or current? Is this
No, this is ICD-10. It's the diagnosis management we use. We've been using ICD-9. This now comes from the UN and the World Health Organization into all hospitals.
We love the UN here.
And the government by fiat is making all hospitals do this. There's about 9 codes from a farm. You have to code it if you're injured on a farm. So you just break your arm. You fall off something, right, at a farm. Mm-hmm. You now have to be coded. Did she fall from a silo, a tree, a house, a vehicle, a tractor? And that is all separate codes. The point is somebody's paying for this overhead for the system to go around and do it. They now also have codes for every separate area on the heart that I place a bypass graft. So I've got to figure out how to do – I have to have a coding book to now because they only want computer speak and, I guess, code to code to code. But there are people populating huge bureaucracies in Washington that think what I just read to you is sensible. And I've already put it in books and have already legislated that that will be used. And that's important to understand. There are people that think this makes sense to work at this level of detail.
Because and they're not doing it.
Well, they are doing it, and they're being paid by the hour.
Well, that's true. And then a chief nursing officer at a hospital in Southern California and I were talking about this on the phone, a good friend of mine. And she says, and she's British, and she said, this is crazy. She said, what's going on in healthcare in terms of documentation is a little bit, like in the military, of a guy going over and, you know, coming around in a battlefield and shooting bullets over in this direction and that direction and shooting that guy and then a grenade over here and then finally coming to rest after a 20-minute engagement with his guys and then stopping everything and having to document everything we did.
Well, I was just going to say, he gets out his BlackBerry.
How many rounds did you put over there and over there and who shot? Did you throw? Do we have all our grenades? What's our grenade count? And the point is
inventory.
That sometimes healthcare and particularly emergency rooms can be a pretty busy place, and documenting at this level of detail is an enormous cost. And I think it tells us two things about who the heck would think this stuff up and who would think it reasonable to impose this on the entire healthcare system at a time when we're trying to also struggle with Obamacare. But it's your government who's done both.
Yeah. Well, anytime we adopt the UN stuff, that's the beginning of the mistake. All right, we'll be back with you in 2 minutes here at We the People Radio. You are listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Community Radio for the North State.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without pride. Now I want to understand.
Lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut. She called the doctor, woke him up and said, doctor, ain't there nothing I can fix?
Bob, you're good.
We told ya. Did we not warn you?
No, you didn't, but this is fun. Thank you.
Okay.
Welcome back.
We're back. I know. I was gonna jump in there quicker, but I love that song.
I know, it's funny.
Waiting for the "Let me get this straight." Yes.
Let me get this straight. Yeah. Were you on burning water skis, or were they not burning by the time you fell?
Yes, I am. You know, I'd forgotten about the ICD-9 codes because I worked in a medical laboratory for a few years, and the phlebotomists would all be assigned to individual draw stations.
Those are blood people.
Where they would be by themselves drawing patients and then having to deal with these codes because all the data had to be input into the computer in order to perform their service. And the frustration level from these phlebotomists having to look up these ICD-9 codes.
Yes.
In order to make anything fly.
Well, that again
was nuts back then.
That was a regulation by the reimbursement industry, both insurance and government. They set a new standard at great cost where you couldn't draw blood unless you had a code, a reason, or a diagnosis. Right. And sometimes a doctor's just, you know, let's see, you know, this, in fact, I'm having this problem. I have a patient upstate here, but he had an aortic valve replaced, and we're just checking his blood count and his clotting. Every time we have to create an ICD-9 code in a different computer system just to get the guy's clotting or his INR done, which he's going to be having this done every other day till he stabilizes. It'll take probably 2 weeks, but he's been at different places, different computer codes, new orders. I mean, we have created the front-end bureaucracy for just the simple service of getting proton. which is a very standard med test. So it's all good, and it's all driven by the reimbursement and documentation structure. And the point is, all of it, there's no free lunch. Everything you force the system to do is going to cost you somewhere. I was actually wrong. I was looking at the break here. The current ICD-9 coding environment that physicians and hospitals swim in has about 14,000 codes. The new one's 140,000.
Wow.
So it's 10 times more. So that means all the business entities and the docs and everybody else and your poor phlebotomist friends are basically going to have these books that have 10 times the number of choices in the detail, because before she draws that blood, she better find out if that patient was on a burning water ski or not, because there's separate codes if it wasn't burning.
Well, see, if you take this out of medical, because I have no experience there, so I just want to get to something I know something about. We were talking about cars earlier.
Yes.
Okay. Well, they have the same thing, if you think about it, for warranty reimbursement. And when I was in the tractor industry, we had that, too. We had to fill out the warranty claims. And so what was wrong and what did you replace? But, you know, with cars, they've gotten so complicated now. They're no longer you can just go out there and change your spark plugs and stuff, and most don't have any. You hook a machine to it. And they have a machine that diagnoses it. And the machine talks to the machine, which ultimately fills out the paper on a machine. Well, that's never going to happen with people.
Well, the nice thing is all Toyota Camrys from 2012 are pretty much exactly the same with the same part numbers
everywhere.
And every injury to a car is different. I mean, to a person. And our body parts are quite a bit different.
Well,
you don't have to be,
your mechanic doesn't have to be a genius with the parts book. In this particular instance, I mean, you can hook a machine to it and it can say it's exactly this, it's doing exactly that. You have a definitive printout that you can turn in. But yeah, with humans, every single one is
and a lot of its different. Best, you know, diagnoses are often movable concepts as you learn more about a patient from your laboratory. So you can come into the emergency room with something as simple as a probable congestive heart failure, which means we're not sure yet, but it could be that. And then as you go along, get your CAT scans and other things, you'll find many other reasons the patient was having a hard time breathing.
So,
and it changes. So you keep creating these data points, all the blood work, and the CAT scan was ordered for this diagnosed congestive heart failure. Well, then later on you find out, gee whiz, no, it was actually something else going on. Left chest was filled with fluid. So that would be a left pleural effusion. So the data is attached to what diagnosis?
So the penalty to the doctors is that if they misdiagnose and send in the wrong code, they don't get reimbursement. And is it true that there's a fine line on fraud with Medicare?
Well, there is. There's a little different. Fraud is if you're making up the reason for it. The truth is what really happens is you want to talk about your lab, and we'll just make up any code that gets the patient the blood work so we can look at the numbers we want. And whatever the first one is gets it usually. As bizarre environment, I'm doing a little confession here, but if I need to see someone's creatinine and I want to look at their electrolytes for a reason, I can put anything on the slip, and the lab will take anything just so they get reimbursed for a set of electrolytes and creatinine. But I'm not going to spend a long time in a book. I'm going to find anything that allows me to just get the test done, because I know in my head why I want the creatinine. I just don't. Why do I need to tell Medicare the basis? You know, I'm not a data collector. I'm not doing a public health type
research. Why do you think they want this level of detail? Because I guess I have a negative mind.
Because they actually have this model in the future will all be electronic medical records, which is a whole other show, by the way, and that somehow it's easy to do. And because it's possible, why does the IRS want all the detail?
Exactly.
Yeah, why do you need 16,000 IRS agents?
Well,
that's just to collect the money.
That's in the middle of this. Is an IRS hire bill. Absolutely. That should put people on. I just think there's some sense that because electronic medical record will make it easier. In truth, electronic medical record is another thrust that's happening to the healthcare right now. And that's a huge, enormous cost at the doctor office level. And the government's coming along with various subsidies and giving you a varying definition of meaningful use. But I just talked to a friend of mine who was a former chief of staff at Long Beach Memorial. He's a urologist. I stayed at his house in Long Beach when we were down visiting. And He told me that they had their National Urologic Society meeting, and they had consulting companies who've come in and looked at the government's current three-year phase-in of the big push for electronic medical records in the offices. And they have a series of increasing fines against the doctors if you don't use these things, and it has to be an approved system, and it has to basically your practice has to demonstrate meaningful use as well as e-prescribing, where you do electronic prescriptions. And these consultants hired by the American Urologic Society, I believe, looked at this, and they looked at the state of the art of the current systems. They looked at the cost of implementation, the increased manpower needs to feed the beast in the office, and the benefits. And the benefits were to avoid the fines, which were 1%, then 3%, then 5%. And he told me that the consultants actually said, just accept the fines. It's going to be much cheaper in the long run than do what the government. And he says the technology is so in its infancy that it'll all blow up and change. And finally, when there's a convulsion in healthcare, when no one can give it because the systems don't talk to each other anyhow, the government will have to retreat on their whole position. They'll probably cancel all the fines anyhow. I mean, it's bizarre, but that was a business plan. That's is now to guess. Well, this year's nice idea by the government, is it likely to last, or are they going to change the rules again? And, of course, that's, again, in Thomas Sowell's book, the one thing the federal government can do well is create uncertainty in the business climate of any industry. Yeah. They do that because they change the rules. And that's really why so much capital is sitting on the sideline in the United States. I sound like I'm jumping subjects, but it's a recurring thing.
It is.
So what's happening is that the government is subsidizing all these companies that they approved to do the electronic medical record, and then they were trying to coerce practices to invest in this technology and actually providing subsidies to it. And then they say, and you guys that don't do it by 2014, we're going to start fining your payments. They're going to reduce your Medicare reimbursement.
How could they reduce it more? I know that
they've done a lot.
Like an office visit to a GP, what is it, $6?
I think it's better than that. But in our reimbursement in cardiac care corrected for inflation, for the 12 years from 1996 to 2008, is down 72%.
Oh, my God.
Crap. Yes. That's correct. That's an honest fact. Those are numbers.
It's a good thing you guys
you can look up the federal numbers. That drives one of the drivers in my perfect storm list. What that does is there's no excess capital in the practices to hire the new generation.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And if there's nobody hiring the new generation, who's going to start the eight-year training program?
Yeah.
So there's many ways in which this environment is being morphed and pressured by the feds. And my own thesis at the end is that this is actually designed to fail, that there'll be a convulsion about healthcare access somewhere down the road. And this is my wild-eyed guess, but if it all fails, then there's nothing left but nationalization of healthcare.
There you go.
And that would be the great crisis out of which we would become single payer. Remember,
and
that
was
the goal. This magical single payer, which is going to be perfect. And the people that want to believe that it will adjust all inequities and issues of access to health care see single payer as being the magic that comes out of the sky, like at the end of an old Roman play, Deus Ex Machina. The god of that comes out of the sky. The machine god comes out of the sky and saves the day. And that is probably enormously overstated. And the problem
is because people are still going to just, be incredibly interested in working in places that nobody wants to live, and, which is a problem now. And it's just a lot of the reasons we have shortage where we have shortage. There are a lot of other factors, lots of other factors.
Well, it's interesting because we got into this business because everybody decides healthcare is a right, but we have a country where even food isn't a right. We believe everybody should be fed. It's a privilege. But I had a friend of mine who we had this disagreement on Facebook, I guess, and I said, I'm sure you just finished Thanksgiving dinner and that 99% of everything on your table was brought to you and presented there and you made available to you by American corporations in the free market.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you
right.
ate. And I said, there's 100,000 people in the Reading area. They eat three times a day. That's 300,000 meals a day. And all the food and all the varieties and all the shifts in seasons, in other words, turkeys at Thanksgiving, and it is brought to you courtesy of a free market that is able to understand that we got to start shipping cranberries in September from the East Coast out to the West Coast so that you have it there. And there's no government regulation of where the cranberries go in the United States, when to start getting the turkeys to market, and how much milk to drop off at Safeway. But pricing and the free market lets the Safeway and the Raley's stock their shelves.
Gosh, consumers.
So when
actually,
you walk in without any federal agency deciding it, you have an enormous choice, and that has been the bounty of the United States of America. It's one example of a free marketplace. And I said, unless you can figure out something else, I said to her, how else are you going to feed 300,000, create 300,000 meals a day in just this region, much less the state of California? Everything you eat is created, trucked, processed, shipped to you, placed on a store shelf, and made available there. Someone's taking the risk that it's going to not be sold before its expiration date, and made available in a nice place that's cool in August, and you can walk in and select anything you want and go back to your home and have a wonderful dinner.
Right.
God bless America. That's all brought to you by a system that we created out of the free marketplace.
Not the government.
Not the government. So why do we not think healthcare couldn't be as easy as that?
Yeah.
And why?
And on that note, we'll take a little break here before the top of the hour. You're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here at KCNR, 1460 AM.
And there's MASH.
Community Radio for the North State. We're going out with MASH.
Here's your request and dedication.
Cutting for the very first time.
Oh, I need these songs. That's great.
Like a crowd pleaser.
Organ transplants. I'm online. Better give me all your gosmers. This patient's fading fast. Complications have set in. Don't know how long he'll last.
And we're back.
Okay, $5 you play that next time you come in the operating room.
Oh,
there you go.
Well, Bob gets it to me. I've heard it, but I wouldn't know where to go look for it. But
it's Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Well, very good.
Pipe that in. They'll be like, who's he been hanging out with?
That's great.
They send up of Madonna's Like a Virgin.
Yes.
All right.
Those two nutty people over on We the People.
Uh-huh. Well, it's
three nutty
with
people.
With their nutty music guru. Yes, yes. Two nutty people and then the nutty music guru we dragged in. Thanks, Bob.
Yep, that was
without
awesome.
That, we wouldn't want to get up in the morning, obviously.
No, this has been great. I love we don't get to have a in-studio guest very often on this show.
A live human. No, most people are on.
They don't live in the area, so they call in.
Ah.
We try to.
Well, I'm happy to do it. You guys are entertaining. And I think it's important for people to read and come to their own conclusions on this subject and others. Mm-hmm. But my epiphany has been to see, whoa, this healthcare reform or Affordable Care Act is part of just the bigger move and march, part of the river that's flowing down this stream of the culture of the Washington bureaucracies, which really do, and I begin to sound like some crazy conspirationalist, which I am not, but by
we like those. Those are our favorite kind. Go ahead.
Frequently accused of that.
But it's when you see this same pattern, and when you see someone as eminent as Thomas Sowell pointed out as an economist in the housing industry, and then you see exactly the same forces at play under the guise of affordable health care, of health care is a right, distribute it to everybody. And in the United States, we don't even technically have a right to housing, but we have an obligation as a people to strive towards being sure people are housed. I'll accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Being a country should be a journey. We're not entirely perfect, nor do we have everything finished. But to discuss, to take a public service, be it well, I guess public schooling would be one. We've claimed that it's the responsibility of the states to provide it, so I guess it's been considered a right, and you can sue for it. In fact, we have groups that have sued it, and that's basically begun. All the rights of education have begun to create issues inside the educational system that have led to enormous challenges in special ed and other areas, and have raised the cost of education and perhaps diluted its effectiveness. When you move to calling health care a right, since it's a service, that means you have to confiscate it from someone and produce it. It has to be distributed. So there are healthcare producers, be they companies that produce pacemakers or defibrillators, be they someone who creates supplies that come to a hospital, or people who put capital up to build a hospital. Then if it becomes a right, no matter what circumstances, that means you now have to confiscate some of those services and goods from somebody to distribute them to someone else, because it's a right. And that we used to call charity, which is basically we were a society that was based on looking out for each other, which I think is really the way we should be constructed. But now when the government decides to be the arbitrator of charity, we get in trouble.
Right. And then producers lose all their incentive.
Well, and then you're in trouble. And that's Thomas Sowell's point.
Yeah.
Once you play the market and you destroy the certainty of what's going on, then you have people who aren't producers. Back to my original thesis, what happens to Obamacare if there's no health care providers?
And that's just
who
that's
are you going to call?
And the specialists, you can't turn that around. You can't even turn around a GP quickly.
Mm-mm.
I mean,
no.
If somebody was really talented.
Well, GPs are very specialized in what they do. It takes a lot of practice and finesse to understand the entire spectrum of health care in a family. And just because you get out of a residency doesn't mean you're done. That's a lifetime process, too.
At what point does the government then, under a national health care system, at what point do they put people into those positions that are not adequately trained?
Or just not gifted,
they may
I
have
guess.
Begun. The dumbing down of physician corps began when we accepted the term provider, which is a very passive thing. Being a provider, that we're now called providers in the legislation and so forth. You'll see that. A physician is far more than a provider. We're thinking it's a two-way process. You're evaluating, you're testing. A good physician is not a provider. But if you're in the computer world, you've got a diagnosis and I provide you the medicine or that. It's very simplistic, but there's far, far more to being a good physician, far more to being a nurse than just showing up and taking orders and pushing medicines. Good nurses are noted for their pattern matching skills, their caring about patients, they're willing to talk about things that aren't the immediate issue. I mean, so the whole healthcare field isn't about just providing diagnoses and cares. It's really about but we're not providers.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never accept that term.
Yeah,
and,
I didn't really
patients,
think about
by
that,
the way, are not
true.
Consumers. They're also directly called
we used
consumers.
To be radio hosts, now we're talk providers.
Yeah. Patients are dependent on my knowledge. Sometimes they're unconscious. There's no interaction. You're dying.
Yeah.
And so a patient becomes my ward. I now accept full personal responsibility for their life. And that's different than a consumer.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Doug McConnell.
All right.
We'll have you on some more.
We need patients and physicians in healthcare, and I think Obamacare is going to dilute that.
Right on.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Hope you learned some stuff today. You're listening to We the People Radio. We'll be back with you next week here at KCNR 1460 AM. Bob, I'm stealing your job. Just go for it.
All right. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, Dr. Doug.
Oh, my pleasure.
It has been a blast. And Don and Judy are next here at the home of community radio in the North State, KCNR.
Ooh, you tried to say home of Free Fire Media.